Good evening. A Gulf monarchy recognizes Israel, but is it hype? New York City principals say September 10th is too early for schools to reopen. The Bronx DA declines to prosecute two cops involved in the death of an emotionally disturbed person, and one city neighborhood organizes to stop evictions. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, August 13th, 2020. Israel and the United Arab Emirates announced on Thursday that they will normalize diplomatic ties. Donald Trump claims to have helped broker the accord where Israel agrees to suspend its planned annexation of the occupied West Bank. The UAE becomes the first Gulf Arab country to officially recognize Israel. President Trump hailed the deal from the White House this morning.
We thought this would be the first country. He's a great leader. Mohammed's a great leader. And we're very happy that he was the first country, I would say. And you're going to see many other things happening in the Middle East over a fairly short period of time. But this is the first time in more than 25 years. And UAE is big stuff. UAE is very powerful, very strong, has one of the strongest militaries. It's big stuff.
Do you know when the delegations are going to meet specifically?
Very soon. I guess they'll be setting up the meetings. Do you have any time?
I think the next several weeks, Mr. President. Then we expect that there will be a meeting here at the White House with the leaders.
There'll be an official signing at the White House over the next few weeks. Okay.
President Trump. Curry Peterson Smith is a Middle East fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He says the accord is a continuation of collaboration between Arab countries and the United States.
It's significant, but not in the sense that it's a departure from what's been happening, but rather a culmination, because politically, Israel and the UAE have been on the same side for a long time. There are not public kind of collaborations between them. And of course, they're both strong allies of the United States. The various wars that the U.S. and its allies are carrying out across the Middle East, the UAE, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and other U.S. allies are all on the same side of this. I hope that we can dispense with the fiction that Israel is surrounded by hostile Arab neighbors, which is a racist and just incorrect assessment of the Middle East. The fact is that the vast majority of Middle Eastern states are actually allied with the United States. So that's one thing. In terms of what this means for the Palestinians, I think the most significant thing is the fact that this is an agreement between three states, the UAE, the United States, and Israel. The Palestinians were not at the table. So there's nothing legitimate about this conversation or agreement about Palestinian land where Palestinians were not present. The fact is that Israel was already, on one hand, they were suspending a bunch of the annexation plans that they were pursuing or they had announced earlier in the year because of the COVID crisis that Israel is facing. But on the other hand, there are aspects of annexation that were already in practice. I mean, when it comes to Israel occupying Palestinian land and controlling land in the West Bank, that is an ongoing thing. In reality, how will this affect what all is happening in Palestine? I don't see that much of an impact.
What's the significance to the world, if any?
Trump is shouting this out as a major breakthrough, and he is once again trying to present himself as this historic peace broker. He's tried to do this a number of times. He claimed that he could achieve peace on the Korean Peninsula, which of course did not work. He said that he could achieve a new goal, something better than what Obama achieved with Iran, which of course has failed. And then he said that he could achieve the deal of the century, the so-called deal of the century, in terms of a new status regarding Israel and the Palestinians. And of course, that has all failed. So Trump is presenting this as evidence that he is able to achieve an agreement that nobody else could achieve. The fact is that the basis for this agreement has been in the making for years. There are people who view this as significant because we are all used to this fiction that Israel is surrounded by these hostile neighbors, and therefore when Israel achieves diplomatic relations with an Arab state, that's held up as something that is like this breakthrough that seemed impossible. But the fact is, if you look at what the UAE has actually been doing throughout the region, its own violence toward and hostility toward Iran, for example, which shares in a big way with Israel in various other ways.
Aren't they involved in Yemen as well?
What the UAE has done in Yemen, and to Yemen, to the people of Yemen. The UAE ended up kind of leaving the Saudi effort, but the UAE continues to carry out operations in Yemen, and it actually carried out special operations in Yemen before being part of this war with Saudi Arabia as well. Yemen, the level of catastrophe that Yemen has experienced year after year, the UAE is a key perpetrator of that.
Corey Peterson-Smith is a Middle East fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. At the Capitol, Republicans and Democrats played the blame game over a stalled coronavirus aid package. There was no serious moves to break the impasse as Washington moves away from legislative affairs on the eve of the major party's national conventions. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said people will die if the delay lasts until September, and White House advisor Larry Kudlow called it a stalemate. Meanwhile, Trump pressed his opposition to voting by mail. He says a sticking point is Democrats' demand for money to assist states in protecting the election and to help postal workers process mail-in ballots. Meanwhile, fears the coronavirus may find a perfect environment to spread are complicating school opening plans across the nation. Within a day of opening schools in Georgia, 1,200 students had been quarantined with the coronavirus. By Monday, a high school had closed its doors for the month, followed by a second school. Teachers and parents said it proved the state's plans to reopen were foolhardy, while Tea Party conservatives said the quarantines proved reopening was a success. In New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan to reopen schools by September 10th, tentatively approved by Governor Andrew Cuomo, has run into growing opposition from teachers and now principals. De Blasio addressed the issue at his daily news conference. He says he's agreed to put a nurse in every school building.
Our colleagues in labor have been putting forward a series of requests and needs. We're going to have different views on each one, but where we can get something done, we're just announcing it. We're saying, you raise this concern, we're answering your concern. And that's what we're going to keep doing. But again, a month is a long time, and I see a lot of educators who are focused on kids and getting ready.
Mayor de Blasio. But a letter from the principals union has urged the city to postpone in-person classes because schools aren't ready and questions are unanswered. The executive vice president of the Council of School Supervisors and Administrators, that's the principals union, is Henry Rubio. He spoke with WBAI earlier today.
For months now, we've been talking to the mayor and his team and sharing the concerns that we have, and our concerns haven't been addressed. The health and safety, as a high school principal that I am, the health and safety of our students is the most important thing, right? Our students and our staff. The city has just started to plan and prepare for the opening way, way too late. School principals are having difficulty getting the school ready for in-person learning. We think that we can start with remote learning on September 10th, right? So the school year will start on September 10th, but we're asking that we need more time for all the logistics involved so that we can start in-person learning later in September. Right now, one of the biggest problems that we're having on the logistical and instructional side of this is that principals are faced with not knowing precisely, until recently, exactly how many of their students were going to be learning remotely and how many are going to be learning in a blended model. Also not knowing how many of our teachers we're going to receive reasonable accommodations to work from home because of underlying health conditions. As a principal, you don't know how many kids are coming to the building, right, definitively, or how many teachers you're going to have in the building and how many of them are going to be remote. They just got that information this week, and there isn't enough time to actually create a schedule in a program without having that information months ago. Typically, Paul, principal would start programming and scheduling for the upcoming September school year in May. So it takes about 3 or 4 months, and we're asking school leaders to do this in 2 weeks. And they've been charged with giving parents student schedules by August 28th, which schools have never done before. As a high school principal, our kids got their schedules a day or two before school opened. Now we're asking them to give them to them a week before. And it's really the time constraint in order to have all the logistics put together. I think when you bring up, Paul, water fountains and the cleanliness in schools, our colleagues, our custodial engineers have been sounding the alarm, and our principals know this. we didn't have enough custodians and cleaning staff before this pandemic. And now we're asking them to do twice the work. We're asking them to both clean and sanitize. And right now, you know, most of our schools haven't seen the equipment in their buildings yet. They know they don't have enough manpower to do all the cleaning and sanitizing necessary to keep schools safe. And it's a tremendous challenge. The city just doesn't inspire a lot of faith from our members or teachers or our school communities.
That's a teacher's lot, is what the mayor was saying. And to a certain extent, that's true. But what's going to happen on September 10th?
Well, I'll tell you this, Paul. Our members are working around the clock to make this square peg fit in a round hole. They won't give up. We know how important it is. I'm a father of three public school children myself. My wife's a teacher. Our kids need to be in school. But we need to make sure that it's safe, that it's orderly, and we're going to do everything possible to get this up and running by September 10th. But unless the city answers the critical questions our principals need answered well in advance and are provided with the resources they need, September 10th is going to be virtually impossible. We're going to need a little bit more time just to get the in-person aspect of the school ready. We can do remote. We know how to do that. There's always room for improvement. We need more time to get the scheduling and programming of the in-person part.
So are we talking about a labor action of any sort?
No, we're not. We're not. You know, right now our members are just dedicated their lives to serving their communities. And they're going to do everything possible to keep our children safe. I got to tell you, our parents trust our principals. And if principals don't feel like their school buildings are ready or safe, they're going to share that concern with our parents. And all we're asking for is to give us a little more time to make sure that we can keep our children safe.
The parents won't bring the kids to school if they don't think it's safe.
I think the vast majority of our parents trust their principals. And if the principal says, well, we're not ready yet, they're not going to send them to school. That's just my personal belief.
Henry Rubio is Executive Vice President of the Council of School Supervisors and Administrators. He's a New York City school principal. Shortly after the CSA letter was released, the United Federation of Teachers Union, comprised of 200,000 members, called for delaying the first day of school as well. As a point of disclosure, this reporter is a part-time New York City school teacher. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The family of an emotionally disturbed man shot to death by a cop in the Bronx in April 2019 are calling on Mayor de Blasio to fire the two officers involved. The demand comes after Bronx District Attorney Darcel Clark decided not to charge NYPD officers Brendan Thompson and Herbert Davis. The victim, 32-year-old Kawasaki Trawick, had been locked out of his apartment and called the fire department, who responded and let him back in. Police later arrived, entered the apartment without a warrant, and confronted Trawick as he was cooking dinner. The co-director of the Justice Committee is Yulsan Lim.
Kawasaki Trawick was a 32-year-old black gay man. He was living in Hill House in the Bronx. Hill House is a supportive living facility. And he was there to get care and support. Like a lot of other New Yorkers, Kawasaki suffered from mental health issues and should have received care where he was at. On April 14th last year, Kawasaki was locked out of his home. He was able to get back in with support from the fire department, but staff members of Hill House had also called the police to come and address him. By the time the police arrived, he was not a threat to anyone. He was in his home. He'd gotten back into his apartment. He was cooking dinner. Officers Brendan Thompson and Herbert Davis pushed open his door. They entered his home, even though they had no evidence that he was involved in criminal activity and he had not given them permission. They escalated the situation every step of the way. They tased him, and then Officer Brendan Thompson shot and killed him.
And what happened as far as the investigation?
Yesterday, staff members from the Justice Committee and also staff members from our coalition Communities United for Police Reform accompanied Kawasaki's mother and several other members of his family virtually to a meeting with the Bronx District Attorney's Office. The Bronx DA told us at that point that they were declining to press charges against Thompson and Davis in spite of the fact that they entered his home without any evidence of a crime and Thompson shot and killed Kawasaki in cold blood. The family is now calling on Mayor de Blasio and the NYPD to hold these officers accountable and fire them immediately. During the meeting, we had the opportunity to look at surveillance footage, to look at the body-worn camera footage from Officer Thompson, to hear 911 calls. We discussed the investigation with the Bronx District Attorney staff. We have no doubt that Kowalski should be alive and with his family today. He absolutely should not have been shot and killed in his own home.
There was problems getting to see the body cam video?
There was. It's been a struggle over the last year and a half to try and get updates and information for the family from the Bronx District Attorney. It's really been, we accompanied Mrs. Trawick and some of her family members to a meeting with the Bronx DA last November. And they told us and they told her that they were prepared to show body camera footage, but only if she made us organizers that were there to support her leave the room. She and her family members were concerned that they were going to see something they didn't understand. They wanted to have their support team present. And so they actually ended up deciding to walk out of that meeting because they felt like they were not able to have the support they needed to really understand what they were seeing and to understand the evidence that the Bronx District Attorney staff was going to be telling them about. Right after the incident happened, the family sent a letter to the Bronx District Attorney's office asking for regular updates and full transparency, and that's not what they got. They got no updates from the Bronx District Attorney at all unless the advocates were knocking on the doors of the DA's office and asking for meetings, asking for updates. So it's been a very frustrating and difficult process for the family.
Where does it go from here? What's next?
The family is calling on Mayor de Blasio and the NYPD to fire these officers. They are clearly a threat to public safety. It's really disturbing that both of these officers were CIT trained.
CIT?
CIT stands for Crisis Intervention Team. The NYPD does CIT training for officers, which ostensibly is meant to give them de-escalation skills. I think we know as an organization that's worked on police violence cases for the last four decades that training really isn't the answer, and this really proves that. When there's no accountability for officers who engage in this kind of behavior, who treat people who really deserve care and support as if they're no better than animals, and you see nothing happening to these officers, both on the criminal level and the departmental level, then the message gets sent to officers that they can do whatever they want and they're not going to be held accountable. And so we really need accountability, particularly with respect to the NYPD's involvement in responding to people who are in emotional distress. The NYPD are not the right people to be engaged in those responses. The position of the Justice Committee is that we need to completely remove the NYPD from any kind of mental health response.
Yulsan Lim is co-director of the Justice Committee. The NYPD claimed Kawasaki was holding a knife to justify shooting him, but according to his family, the man was holding a knife because he was cooking dinner. And with the city facing the possibility of mass evictions, as eviction moratorium is set to expire in early September, activists are getting ready for the worst. On Manhattan's Lower East Side, notices are going up announcing an eviction watch of residents willing to turn out at a moment's notice to stop city marshals from carrying out evictions. Longtime housing activist Reverend Frank Morales is a retired Episcopal priest from the neighborhood.
Our goal is to develop in the East Village the capability to call out people in a rapid way who've already been signed up as part of a network, who understand what their immediate responsibilities are. They can sign up to be involved in civil disobedience, or they can, as participants, videographers, they can't come, they can call from work, from the city or the landlord, the owner, who's the one, the target, that needs to be persuaded to call off the marshals, including the marshals' offices and various other places. So that's the idea, to develop an East Village eviction-free zone so that on the streets, people are linking arms and coming together, and we're going to provide the kind of mass mobilizations in the community to defend and protect our neighbors. It entails having the capability, a kind of technological capability, to reach out to hundreds of people in a community so that they are immediately made aware that there's an eviction in progress, a threat of an eviction, and they will come out, literally come out into the streets to where they're directed to come and be part of an opposition force. That opposition force can take any number of forms, depending on the person and their capability, their wish, you know, how they want to be involved.
What would be the goal?
The two things. Immediately to force back the marshals, to have the marshals and the owner, who are attempting to evict this person, throw up their arms and say, we're not doing this, to repel the forces that are there to evict people, to create the opening for policy change. There's no heat on the street. There's no policy change. And the kind of changes we're looking for are the banks, the well-heeled politicians, the real estate industry in this city, any number of sources have to kick in funds to subsidize both the owners and or the tenants. They can devise ways in which, you know, how they want to do that in order to alleviate the pressures that have been brought about, economic pressures through the pandemic. It's not like the small owners are not losing money. They're losing money as well. Clearly, there needs to be an infusion of capital, whether it's through some new fangled approaches that the mayor is able to come up with, talking to his well-heeled buddies. But somebody's got to give. And the only way that we're going to get to that possibility is if we create a resistance on the street.
Seems easier when the city and the economy is on the way down than back in the squatter days when it was on the way up.
It could be that folks are, for various reasons at this point, more likely to come together and whatever, you know, whatever the circumstances are. I mean, you know, the other side of that coin is that, you know, through the kinds of evictions that could potentially take place if there's no real opposition, you know, can fuel gentrification of these neighborhoods around the city. You know, you force out a lot of poor and working class people. Suddenly the opportunities are there, you know, further gentrify communities. Lord knows we've had enough of that here in the East Village. The mass base for this kind of opposition was there. And last thing I'd say is that through this opposition and through our victories and coming together and defending one another, these crises create opportunities. And I think maybe this is the time to envision alternative forms of housing. The system of housing for profit is archaic and immoral and unjust. We need to transcend it, move beyond it. So this period provides the opportunity to envision other forms of cooperative, land trust, collective means of housing one another, a social approach to housing that is fair and equitable rather than predatory and geared only to making profit.
Reverend Frank Morales, a retired Episcopal priest, is a longtime housing activist. He advocated for hundreds of squatters who battled to save their homes against gentrification in 1990s New York. Robert Desir, a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Society, agrees it's necessary for tenants to get ready for anything.
There is definitely a need to be concerned about what is going to happen. There are thousands of cases that have been paused and that were winding their way through the courts before the moratorium took place. People whose cases have been adjudicated and but for the pause would have received an eviction notice. At this point, the governor, I know, issued another executive order. However, that has limitations. The courts, however, issued a moratorium back in March, which suspended evictions until further notice. That remains in effect. The governor's executive order, I think, protects some groups of people, but not all. So the only thing providing the widest protection is the court's administrative order issued in March. There is a lot of uncertainty. Tenants are hanging on by a thread. We're hoping that the state and local officials will act to pass more comprehensive protections and also provide funding for the number of people who have been out of work, unable to work, and have seen their pay either significantly diminished or gone altogether and can't pay their rent and have accrued significant arrears.
The president made an executive order on evictions over the weekend. Does that apply to what we're talking about here?
This latest executive action from the White House didn't really have any teeth. It didn't really say what exactly it would do. It doesn't provide any concrete protections that tenants can rely on and assert as a defense if they are sued and the landlord seeks their eviction. In New York, what is protective is the court's administrative order, which is not much because it's noted that it is in effect until further notice, another condition for as long as federal and state COVID-related protections remain in effect. Regardless of what type of housing you live in, whether it's rent stabilized, whether it's federally subsidized, whether it's free market, any action the landlord wants to take to remove somebody, they have to start a housing court proceeding.
What is it like in housing court right now? What's going on today?
There are a limited amount of proceedings that are taking place, particularly those who had two attorneys. They've been allowed to continue. Certainly is not what we would typically see there. There is concern about ramping up of activity as we go into the different phases of opening. The main concern is the thousands of cases that are ready to go and the potential wave of evictions that would bring.
What about illegal evictions?
Yeah, we have seen that. I think there are circumstances where landlords can take action and move forward, particularly if they're claiming that there is some kind of dangerous condition that needs to be addressed right away. There's also landlords sending predicate notices. So they are allowed to proceed in some form. The courts are not issuing notice of eviction and not entering judgments at this point. So there is some safety there, but just in the name of delaying what is to come. And we're hoping that there is a lot of assistance from the state and from the federal government to give rent relief for the people that are in need. We know that currently the state of emergency will last until September 6th. A lot of the protections that have been put in place are dependent upon the existence of the state of emergency. We're kind of moving forward towards reopening schools, reopening a lot of our functions. So we're really keeping an eye on what is going to happen in September.
Robert Desir is a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Society. And that's some of the news for Thursday, August 13th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News from New York, I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Thanks for listening.